I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's going to be cold tonight, but spring has sprung, kind of, sorta. The Orioles open their season in the win column, and we're at T-minus 10 weeks and counting to Maryland's June primary election. Today, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates. Krish Vigdaraja is my guest. She served at the State Department and in the White House as policy director to Michelle Obama. She's a lawyer, and she's one of nine Democrats running in the primary for governor. She is the only woman at the top of the ticket in a year in which nearly twice as many women are seeking office in Maryland than in 2014. Can she prevail in a crowded primary? And if so, does she have what it takes to beat a very popular incumbent governor? Krish Vigdaraja joins me right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall on this Friday, this Good Friday for Christians, this first night of Passover for Jews. So we welcome everybody. We continue our series of conversations with the candidates today, the folks who will be on the June 26th primary ballot here in Maryland. Today, my guest is Krish Vigdaraja, a Democratic candidate for governor. She announced her candidacy last fall, and she has plenty of company. There will be nine Democrats on the ballot in June. The winner will go up against Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election in November. Several candidates have chosen women as their lieutenant governor running mates, but Ms. Vigdaraja is the only woman running for the top job. Her running mate is Sharon Blake, the former head of the Baltimore Teachers Union. Krish Vigdaraja served as policy director to First Lady Michelle Obama. She was also a senior advisor at the State Department for both Secretaries of State Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. Before working in the Obama administration, she was a consultant at McKinsey & Company. She is a Yale and Oxford-educated lawyer who practiced law in Washington, D.C. She clerked for Chief Judge Michael Budin on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, and she served as an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. She is 38 years old. Her husband, Colin O'Mara, is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. They live in Gaithersburg with their baby daughter. We are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page, and we will begin taking your questions and comments a little later in the program. But Krish Vigdaraja, it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
So on your website, which is very beautifully laid out and very classy, it opens with an image of 14 men, the Maryland governor, the lieutenant governor, our congressional and senatorial delegation, and you make the point that there are no women in that picture. How should voters, you have gone to some lengths to remind voters that you are the only woman in this race. How should voters frame that fact, and how should they think about gender in this race?
It's a great question, because I want to be clear that this is not just about representation. This is about policy. And the ad that you'll actually see on the webpage, if you go to krishformaryland.com, is one that highlights the fact that when you have more women in leadership positions, whether it's in elected office, whether it is in boardrooms or courtrooms or classrooms, you get better policy results. And that's something that's not new to Marylanders, in the sense that if you poll Marylanders, the majority of them believe that we need more women in office. And so for me, it's about the unique perspective that I bring. And yet, in a state like Maryland, the state of Harriet Tubman and Barbara Mikulski, Helen Bentley, Beverly Byron, Connie Morella, we have had powerful, strong, opinionated women who have been leading the charge for a very long time. And yet, we find ourselves in 2018 in a very unique position. And so whether it is on issues of education, paid family leave, sexual harassment, and dealing with the climate in Annapolis and the Me Too movement, or on revitalizing our economy and protecting our environment, making sure that our children have safe water and clean air to breathe. Those are all issues that are women's issues, and they're issues that I'm championing.
Is the fact that you're a woman the primary central qualification that you bring to the job? Because it is the thing, it's the first thing that you see, mm-hmm. and it's the thing that you are talking a lot about on the campaign trail. I mean, to what extent does it inform, obviously it will, mm-hmm. anybody's personal lived experience is going to inform her policy approach. But the fact that there aren't any women in statewide office, I mean, you say there are none. Actually, I thought of Nancy Kopp, the state treasurer, mm-hmm. who does hold statewide office.
But not elected by the general electorate, right?
Yeah. Right. But she is the fact that you're a woman as a reason to vote for you. Dig down into that a little deeper.
Yeah, and I appreciate that question because I don't expect or want people to vote for me just because I'm a woman. But I also don't want to hide the fact that I'm a woman because I do think that that brings a unique vantage point. And I want to talk about it in a couple respects. So first, for starters, because I know that we will talk about a range of policy issues, the truth is that none of those conversations matter unless we can actually get a Democrat in office. And so, you know, in the video, I say this, and I suppose I should repeat it here, which is when the orthodoxy out there is that we have the second most popular Republican governor, popular governor in the country. And the conventional wisdom is that no man can beat Larry Hogan. I do mean it when I say I'm no man. And I mean it in the sense that if you look at the opportunities that Democrats have to beat incumbent Republicans, in the last year, you've seen 61% of those pickups have been by women who have run for those offices. In an electorate, we're expecting about 60 to at least 65% of the turnout to be women. There's a real opportunity there that perhaps only a woman in the field has an advantage of.
And is this year then a particular sort of sui generis year to the extent that this year, according to the Washington Post, 44% more women running for office in Maryland?
Yeah.
I mean, nationwide, it's similar. But in Maryland, nearly twice as many running this time than ran in 2014.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a movement? And we've seen movements in Virginia, for example, in which a lot of women, the video of women standing online, as the polls closed, to make sure they got their vote in. Is this a political calculation as well then?
Well, I mean, I just think that you're seeing it in race after race. Virginia, you mentioned, if you looked at Texas more recently, you saw women winning across the state. And I do think part of it is that people say 2018 is the year of the woman. And I think that is a reflection of the fact that women are sick and tired of politics as usual. I think obviously a lot of people were awoken by the November election. And so in my view, I do think and I hope that this is waking a sleeping giant because women have the power in their hands to decide who gets elected.
For the first time in a long time, the Democratic Central Committee of Maryland, Kathleen Matthews is the DNC chair or the Maryland Democratic chair, is having separate the genders will be separate for election to the Central Committee. So you vote for a slate of women and you vote for a slate of men. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, would it be ideal if we didn't have a quota system and we could get to parity? Absolutely. Do we realize that in every environment that diversity matters and it leads to better outcomes? Absolutely. And so if that's how we're going to get to parity, I absolutely support it. And this is where I do think we should recognize it is a matter of policy. In Maryland, we come in 50th out of 50 when it comes to child care subsidies. We, as of a month ago, were arguing about rapists having paternity rights. Maryland was one of the six states that allowed that. That bill had been introduced 9 times in committee. The last time it failed was in an all-male executive committee. And that's where I just think that, the fact that we come in number 6 in terms of highest rates of breast cancer deaths, you're seeing time and time again in a range of issues that, having women at the table matters. And I think especially now.
You served at the federal government, in the White House, and at the State Department. One of the reasons that Ms. Matthews, the chair of the Democratic Party here in Maryland, cites for having separate genders elected to the Central Committee is that Maryland has a history of sort of promoting from within. You get involved in the Central Committee, you run for a city council or a county council, then you run for larger offices, and people sort of run up. You're starting with the state's top job. Why?
Yeah. I mean, I think, it's not new for women, I think, to hear sometimes the wait your turn or are you sure this is the first thing that you should run for? And I will tell you, it was actually a number of women who approached me about running. Candidly, I hadn't thought about running for governor when I came out of the White House. People had talked to me about running for office. But the reason why I decided to run and I think why I was convinced was because I think we all know what's at stake. We have schools that are literally crumbling. We have an economy that is falling behind compared to neighboring states. We have have air pollution that is literally killing our children and causing asthma at rates that are higher than neighboring states. And so that's, for me, what's at stake and why I realize that we have an opportunity here to course correct in a state where, when I grew up, we had schools that provided even kids like me who went to, struggling schools. I went to Edmiston Heights for elementary and then Woodbridge Elementary, Johnny Cake Middle, Woodlawn High School. Most people only know my high school because of the podcast Serial. And I had the chance
to go.
Back
in the news today.
Exactly. I had the chance to go from Woodlawn to the White House to work for Michelle Obama as her policy director, to serve as senior advisor, only because of the opportunities that I got growing up here in Maryland. And what I worry is that the next generation, including kids like my daughter, don't have those same opportunities anymore. And so that's where I realized that, waiting my turn, waiting to see if, there was a lower seat that I could run for in order to prepare to run for governor, wasn't the best option because, frankly, I've had experience at the executive level. I've managed a $51.6 billion budget when I was at the State Department. I've run multi-billion dollar initiatives for the president and first lady. I've had a career in law and business as well. And so for me, it was looking deep down and saying, are there reasons for me to run that compel me? Because obviously it's a lot of sacrifice. And obviously there is a strong field that I'm excited to be a part of. But I also realize that there are unique perspectives that I bring. There's unique qualifications that I have. And obviously we touched on being a woman. I think that that is one part of it. But, I'm not expecting people to elect me because I'm the only woman in the field. But I do believe that if they recognize that there are unique perspectives that I also bring, that is helpful. But I'm running because, I think there's a lot of folks out there who feel like there is a need for new leadership and a clear vision. And so what I say to voters is, look, if you're happy with the status quo, then I'm probably not your candidate. If you want to blow up the system, then I'm probably not your candidate. But if you fall somewhere in between and you're part of that moderate majority that, frankly, in some ways believes that neither party represents them, then I hope people take a hard look because that's what I represent.
Let's talk about that policy perspective that you bring. As a policy director to First Lady Michelle Obama and at the State Department, how does being a policy wonk, which I'm going to assume you are, if your title was policy director in the Obama
administration. Watch out. Once I start, you can't stop me.
That's right. How does that translate into political leadership, into getting legislation passed, into developing consensus, into, finding solutions that people can glom around?
Yeah. I mean, and this is where When Hogan ran in 2014, he ran on slogans. Now he's going to run on a track record, right? And that's where, for me, I want people to look at my track record. So let me try to describe it in concrete terms. I have forged, I've taken ideas, forged plans and compromise around them, built initiatives and executed. So Let Girls Learn is a good example of that, where I took it from a seed of an idea to bringing in seven agencies across the federal government and $1 billion of government funding. But for me, it is always...
Excuse me, is this in the White House or the State
Department?
This
was in the White House, yep. And Let Girls Learn was an initiative about how do we get more of our girls to complete their middle and high school educations. And I made sure that we had the buy-in because sometimes people are surprised by this fact, but Michelle Obama was not a government employee. So it's not
as though it was an unpaid position.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not like we had immediately at our beck and call the federal government. So much of it was, this sort of game of inception. How do you get buy-in into an idea that I believe is nonpartisan or bipartisan in a way that people are actually willing to allocate resources, assets, funding, time, energy to that effort? So beyond bringing in the government part of that, for me, it was always about how do you leverage taxpayer dollars? Because that's how I think we're going to get a lot of disillusioned voters out there to believe that we are fiduciary stewards of hard-earned taxpayer dollars. So I brought in over 100 partners and over $3 billion of private capital. So that's the kind of programming I want to see. And so if you want to translate that into universal pre-K, it's a good example of where most of us, I think, fully appreciate, and I say this as Democrats or Republicans, that it is one of the best investments we can make. For every dollar we invest, we get a $38 return, $19 between kindergarten and 12th grade, another $19 after graduation. And so what I have seen is across the state, across the country, public-private partnerships forged on that basic fact. In Philadelphia, you have the Penn Foundation working with the government. In Boston, you have the Barr Foundation working with the government. You have the Gates Foundation working across the country. And yet here in Maryland, people time and time again say, well, we can't afford that. And I'm like, who are you kidding? We know that we can't afford to not take those measures and that we can find private entities to pick up the tab. And so my basic promise is I will not put a single taxpayer dollar to something that I can make sure I can find a private partner to pay for. And that's a great example of where I will forge public-private partnerships around that policy.
Does that make you sort of the fundraiser in chief then for the state of Maryland or
yeah.
the governor? I mean, because at some point, isn't it also the function of government to say this is a priority yeah. for our citizenry.
Yes.
This is something that's important to society. Therefore, the government should fund universal pre-K because it matters to all of us.
Exactly. Yep. So for me, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not as though I will only be instituting policies where I can find private partners. And this is where I appreciate your correction, because for me, it's about having the vision, being able to put the program together, and then figuring out how do you make sure you fund it. And not to say it's a linear thinking, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of politicians who, frankly, have left a lot of voters disillusioned because they come in with these promises made and promises unkept. And so for me, and maybe this is not the best strategy to run on, but I will underpromise, overdeliver. And so every single policy I've put forth, I want to make sure that there is a funding stream or way in which I can make sure we can actually execute.
Krish Vignaraja is a lawyer who served in the Obama White House as policy director to First Lady Michelle Obama. She was also a senior advisor at the State Department. She's one of 9 Democrats running in the June primary for the chance to face Republican Governor Larry Hogan in the general election in November. We'll have more with Krish Vignaraja when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. You can also ping us on Facebook. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on the program, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. Former state delegate John Olszewski Jr. is a Democratic candidate for Baltimore County Executive. He'll join me here in Studio A. Plus, the Afro Check-In with Kamau High. He's the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper. That's all coming up Monday on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Krish Vignaraja. She is one of 9 candidates running in the June primary to be the Democratic nominee for governor. You can hear all of our conversations with the candidates at WIPR.org/midday. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with Krish Vignaraja. 410-662-8780. We're streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR, and you can send us an email, midday@wipr.org. We do have one caller on the line. Let's go to him now. James in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Krish Vignaraja.
Good afternoon, Tom and your guests. I'm a father and a parent and education advocate for over 20 years. And I'm a Democrat. I voted for Governor Hogan because, number one, we needed balance, because when we had Democrats in office, our taxes went up and everything went in the toilet. So I believe in having more balance than just having one party running things. And as an education advocate, I believe in pre-K universal. But one thing that nobody ever talks about is middle school is a quagmire for most students. And in particular in Baltimore, our test scores are abysmal. And middle school is where a lot of kids get lost and dropout rate increases, because middle school is never adequately addressed. And I'd like to know, what does she think about that? Because you could send a child to elementary school and they could be at grade level. But over time, what happens is they fall behind, and when they get to middle school, nobody helps them, and they're thrown like to the wolves.
All right. Well, thank you, James. Appreciate that call. Education, certainly a big part of your platform.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. James, thank you for that question, because you're exactly right. And this is where we've got to remember that government needs to be there every step of the way. And I say this from the perspective both as the only candidate in the field who's the product of Maryland public schools from kindergarten through 12th grade, but also as the daughter of two Baltimore City public school teachers. So my father had taught in the Baltimore City school system for 37 years. He finally retired in June at the age of 80. My mother started at Poly. She retired from Oregon State. And I couldn't agree with you more, because the number of kids that my parents would get in high school who you could tell had fallen off the rails in middle school or earlier is where you realize that, particularly in those years of middle school where there's a lot going on, is where we need to really focus.
And so how's the state government fix that?
Yeah. I mean, so for me, this is where my policies are not piecemeal. They're very holistic, and that's intentional. What I want to see as governor, we institute, is policies cradle to career. So I obviously touch on universal pre-K, but I don't want that to be misunderstood as that's where we leave thinking our job is done. Exactly. Kind of the opposite perspective of what I take. I want to make sure we're fixing the funding inequities, but every teacher, including James, I'm sure you'd agree with this, is it can't just be about money. You got to figure out how you're allocating that funding. Part of it is rebuilding our crumbling schools, but more of it is about making sure that the curriculum provides to make sure that every child is guaranteed success. And so what I mean by that is I want to invest in science, technology, engineering, arts, math, financial literacy, civics education, not just at the high school levels, but at the elementary and middle school levels as well. Because I will tell you,
but what does that mean for the state to invest in particular curriculum?
Yeah, I mean, so every school probably needs at least $2 million of investment in terms of improved curriculum that actually reflects what our children need to learn to come out and not just be able to, you know, teach for the test, but actually to be productive citizens. And I mean that not just in terms of being able to make educated decisions when they vote, but actually being, fulfilled. And I sound, maybe this sounds silly, but actually happy, fulfilled children. And that's where, making sure that each school has guidance counselors who are dealing with the fact that if we don't provide those sorts of resources to address behavioral problems, mental health problems, that what we're going to get are kids who are disruptive when they come to high school.
So then what should the funding formula for schools be? Obviously, the Curbin Commission is going to issue some recommendations. Mm-hmm. Lord knows when.
Yeah.
But what should that be? What would you like to see in that set of recommendations?
Yeah. I mean, so we have to recognize where Maryland is on this curve, in the sense that we have one of the worst funding inequities of the country. Schools that are struggling get about...
Between jurisdictions you're talking
exactly.
About.
So schools that are struggling get about 5% less than some of our wealthier schools. And so when people talk about top of the nation schools, there's a vast differential between some of the top schools in Montgomery County and Howard County and schools like the school I went to in Baltimore County, when I went to Woodlawn High School. And so part of that is programs like the one that I benefited from. When I was at Woodlawn, I was in a math engineering magnet program, which was funded thanks to Governor Schaefer and Governor Glendening. And it's noteworthy because Governor Glendening is actually the last governor we've had who actually went from Maryland Public Schools kindergarten through 12th grade. And I say that to note that part of it is actually living the experience that our children are going through. I was in so-called temporary trailers when I was going through school. Those trailers are still there when I went back to the high school.
But of course, as you know, different jurisdictions have different problems. Baltimore County is overcrowded. Mm-hmm. Baltimore City is undercrowded. Right. I mean, they got buildings that are empty.
Exactly. And that's because a lot of parents are fleeing to try to figure out if there's other schools that they can have access to in the county. And my point is that no child, just depending on what district they grow up in, what zip code that they're born into, should have some determination of whether they're going to realize their potential. And so this is where, James, to your question, we've got to figure out how do we make sure that every child is not going to end up in this school to prison pipeline. And part of that is allocating resources after school programs. When I was in the White House, we had very strong mentoring programs that are not just for the kids who were top of their class, but the kids who had clear potential, but either because of socioeconomic problems, family problems, medical problems, they were falling further and further behind our resources need to be especially allocated to those children.
We have a comment from Facebook. This is from Maria, who says, focus on private funding, Government steps in where economics do not support private solutions. What is your position on big tax giveaways to buy jobs that may not come or stay? What are transit plans for better intra-region commutes? Again, this notion of the role of the private sector and the role of the government.
Yeah. So Biden would say this in the administration, which is, if you want to know your values, look at your budget. And so part of it for me is when sometimes people say, well, how are you going to fund that? My point is that if this is a top priority, education, for example, we're not going to try to find the scraps to pay for the $2.9 billion budget deficit. We're going to make sure that that is first and foremost funded. But part of it is, you know, kind of to the question and what it alludes to is we can't just give these corporate write-offs to, you know, Amazon has obviously been in the news most recently. Look, my point is that, I come at this as a lawyer. If you want to make sure that funding is, you get your best return on that investment, you've got to make sure that the restrictions and provisions are in place to guarantee a certain set of jobs at a certain income. Because otherwise, what we are, we're just handing money that is obviously in scarcity over to big corporates like Amazon who don't need it. So you can't have our kids shivering in our classrooms. And yet, a week later, say, I'm going to give a $5 billion tax write-off, and investments to Amazon.
But Amazon might say, and I have no idea what Amazon would say, but perhaps they would say, we don't need it. Jeff Bezos is a wealthy man, et cetera, but we're going to bring 50,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they're promising.
Yeah, yeah.
And 50,000 jobs. So the calculation for state government is what's worth it.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
What do we give in order to get 50,000 people living in the state making a good wage?
Right. And this is where, you know, I don't want this to be some sort of political pandering where I have decided out of hand that it's not a smart investment. But for me, it's we've got to make sure we make that calculus. Meaning, you'll hear this time and time again as I think about decision-making and talk about being wonkish. It is the cost-benefit analysis. It's evidence-based decision-making. If I know that we've got 50,000 jobs, and I can guarantee that that is going to be at an average salary of $70,000 to $100,000, based on my back-of-the-envelope calculation, we need to make sure that Amazon is in Maryland for at least 20 years. Now, if we can get those guarantees, then it's worthwhile for us to look at what that is going to entail. But if we can't, what we've seen in state after state is a company will come in, they will promise the moon and stars, and then when it is expedient for them for various set of reasons to relocate to somewhere else that is going to give them a better buy-off, they relocate. And so that's where, you know, as a lawyer, I approach this the same way that I approach the education lockbox, which is, listen, if you're going to make sure that that funding is promised for our education spending, let's make sure that there are guarantees and restrictions in place to make sure the funding goes there. When it comes to transportation, this is a broader set of issues. And I think it speaks to how would I approach this as governor in terms of budgeting? Because if you look at Maryland, we have a 1950s budget in many ways. We spend about as much on prisons and policing as we do on higher education. We spend twice as much on roads as we do on public transit, knowing that we have the worst commutes in the country. And so part of what I want to see is we resurrect the red line. We look at the purple line to make sure that we have the perfect alignment for it, but we move forward with that. But we also have to recognize that, you know, this idea of a $9 billion roads plan is not going to be the solution. And this is where it speaks to a broader point of how should we be approaching Governor Hogan's track record? Because I've started to talk about them as election year epiphanies. After doing nothing for 3 years on transportation, except for naming the ICC after the only other Republican one-term governor, all of a sudden, Governor Hogan has decided that he's going to try to address the roads problem. Likewise with crime here in Baltimore. After doing nothing for 3 years, except for forgetting Baltimore, literally forgetting Baltimore on a map, he's come into town and said, oh, this is about truth and sentencing, and I need to target the judges. We know that mass incarceration is not working. And so those ideas, those policies, I believe, are a day late and a dollar short. And I think voters are going to hold him accountable.
Krish Vignaraja is running in the Democratic primary for governor. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org to find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. And you can also find us on the Facebook page at WIPR. We are streaming live. Let's talk about the logistics of government when it comes to education, the school construction bill, which the House and Senate have now passed pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. The governor has threatened to veto it. This is a sort of in the weeds, wonkish thing for folks who haven't been following it. But the governor says that oversight of school construction spending should lie in the Board of Estimates, mm-hmm. The treasurer, the comptroller, and the governor. And the legislature says, nope, we're going to have an independent commission do this. What's your stand?
Yeah, I mean, this is where the system is clearly broken. And the fact that you had water heaters and, you know, heaters in general that break in school after school, that we made not just national but international headlines because of schools having to close as a result of the failure to invest appropriately in our schools is a reflection of that. Now, I think that the decision was the correct decision. But of course, we can't just assume that putting this into an independent entity's hands will be the solution. We've got to make sure that there aren't lobbyists or people who have self-interests in place that aren't aligned with our students and our children making these decisions. But I also think that we need to be much more efficient in terms of the decision making. We need to make sure that when funding is allocated, that it actually goes to where that funding is intended to go. And so that's where I do think that a new system is in place and the appropriate decision.
When it comes to economic development, talking about things that, you know, election year epiphanies and promises that politicians make that they may or may not be able to keep, your plan calls for 250,000 more jobs. I hear this all the time from folks in your position. They come in and they say, we're going to have 75,000 jobs in Baltimore, 250,000 in the state, or 15,000 in Baltimore County or something. How do you know? Yeah. Where does that number come from?
Well, the easiest thing is knowing that, you know, as soon as we resurrect the red line, that is 250,000 jobs that exist that are not filled.
Can we resurrect it without the $900 million from the federal government?
Yes. I mean, don't get me wrong. I come from the federal government. I want to make sure every single dollar we can get from the federal government for an infrastructure plan where we can find funding, we will get. But the truth is that we know we have the money for this, and in part because it pays for itself. So, and I say this partly based on a personal experience, which is that when my family grew up in Edmondson Heights, so right on the Baltimore County, Baltimore City line, my parents came with no jobs, $200 in their pockets. We couldn't afford.
And you were how old when your family emigrated from Sri Lanka?
From,
right?
Sri Lanka,
yeah.
Nine months.
About
exactly.
The age of your daughter
exactly
now?
Exactly right. And we couldn't afford a car. And my dad was lucky enough to be able to find a job at Edmondson High. But if we didn't have public transportation, you would have had a family of four living on welfare as opposed to his single income. And you know that that is what transportation is. It's a gateway to opportunity. But for me, there is no single solution. So I don't want to say we just invest in transportation and that is going to solve the problems. Part of it is that we need to invest in infrastructure beyond transportation, meaning universal high-speed broadband. You've seen in, you know, airports, some cities where they guarantee universal high-speed broadband because we realize that this is access to an important ingredient of any economy, which is the internet. And yet here in Maryland, you still have 500,000 people who are not connected to the internet. But it's a bigger set of issues, including small businesses, making sure that we are guaranteeing small businesses the support they need to succeed. But it's also a broader issue than that, which is when I want kids to come out of school, they have to either be career ready or college ready. So if a child wants to become an electrician, like my cousin, or a pipe fitter or a welder, the number of employers who tell me here in Baltimore and across the state that they have jobs that are not filled because they don't have employees with the skill set is why I want to make sure that we provide free community college, free technical education, job retraining, but also apprenticeship programs.
All right, we'll talk a little bit about that after a break. Before we go to the break, though, having to do with this notion of the internet, Julia from Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Krish Vignaraja. And evidently, you do not have access to the internet. Do I understand that correctly?
No, I do not.
And so what do you think you should, Julia? I mean, do you think it's up to the state or the city where you live to provide broadband access?
Well, thing of it is I don't have a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And
are you interested in getting one? Is that something you feel that you're missing, or are you fine without one?
Well, sometimes I would like to have one, but then I don't think I would get anything done because I would be on it all the time.
Well, I think there, folks with phones know all about that.
That definitely is resonating.
Well, thank you for checking in, Julia. I appreciate it. But you know, what about broadband access? Is that something that the state should do?
Yes. I mean, I think we have to recognize that in 2018, we are talking about a public utility. It is something that it connects people to the economy. So especially when we're talking about Western Maryland, the Eastern Shore, but even here in, you know, Baltimore City, the county, you realize that there are people, and thank you for calling in, who are not connected to the internet. And so, you know, it's a broader set of issues. Obviously, if you have a lack of a computer, then we have a broader set of problems. But this is something where I think the government has to play a role, and you've seen other states do it in proactive ways. But that also is where net neutrality, this idea that a state can't play a role, is absurd, because you've seen it in other states, including Colorado, where we can make sure that as governor, we can guarantee the companies are not going to be able to, based on their financial incentives, push information your way. That's just wrong.
Okay, we got to take a break. Julia did have a question, though, about whether or not you're going to send out mailers and flyers, because she's one of those folks without an internet. That's a cost to you and your campaign. Are you going to have the money to be able to do that kind of
Absolutely.
Work?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Julia, keep an eye on your mailbox. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back. Krish Vignaraja is a Democratic candidate running for governor of Maryland. Her running mate is Sharon Blake, longtime Baltimore City public school teacher and the former president of the Baltimore Teachers Union. You can join us when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us in the Twittersphere, @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Krish Vignaraja is here. She's a lawyer and a former official in the Obama administration. She's one of nine Democrats running for governor of Maryland. Her opponents in the June primary include Rashern Baker, Kevin Kamenetz, Ben Jealous, Richard Modaleno, Alec Ross, Jim Shea, and two others. If you have questions for Krish Vignaraja, our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. On Facebook, Flo gets in touch and says, let's keep going into the policy issues. I want to hear more about your plans for these public-private partnerships, particularly around healthcare, education, development without displacement, childcare subsidies, and more. I mean, what we've talked about so far is a lot of really good things, universal pre-K and transportation and stuff. But to win an election against a governor who is as popular as he is, he's going to have strong Republican support. Any Democratic candidate who goes up against Mr. Hogan is going to have to draw some Republican votes. So what do you say to that Republican voter? Well, you're saying maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
But assuming my puerile political calculation is correct. What do you say to the Republican voter who says, well, that's all nice and good, but how do you pay for it? I mean, Mr. Hogan's pitch, to a certain extent when he ran the last time, was fiscal responsibility, reining in the, you know, tax and spend proclivities of Democrats on the left. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, and this is where, you know, look, I am someone who describes myself, although I try to avoid the labels, because I do think the labels and the purity tests are frankly destructive on both sides of the aisle. But the shorthand way you could describe me is fiscally responsible and socially progressive. There are people in the field who will promise you free this, that, and the other. But I know that what that means is taxpayer dollars spent, unless you can obviously find a way through a public-private partnership to pay for it. And so for me, it's about trying to identify what are those strategic investments. So, you know, I mentioned universal pre-K. I've mentioned free community college. It's one of those things where what I'm trying to find are ways in which we are not just educating our children and empowering them in terms of realizing their potential, but also growing our economy. And this is where Hogan can talk about how Maryland has been open for business. But when you actually drill down into the numbers, we're far from where we need to be. We come in 28th to 33rd when it comes to unemployment rates. Comparing us to Virginia, we lose in terms of real wages by about $6,000 to $7,000. Compared to Delawareans, we are behind about $10,000 to $12,000. And so that's where we've got to figure out a way to grow a resilient, diversified economy. Now, I've talked about infrastructure and making those investments. That's one part of the piece, one part of the puzzle. Another part is actually growing our innovation economy, because we have world-class universities like Johns Hopkins, UMBC, College Park, federal institutions like NIH, Fort Detrick, FDA. And yet we come in 28th when it comes to startups. We get 0.5% of venture capital funding. And so if we actually grew our biotech, our cybersecurity, our IT corridors, you realize that we could be competing not just with Massachusetts, but with California. And yet we don't. And part of it is, and I'm going to say we've got to take the blame, how we approach this. Some of the conversations we need to have is, if Democrats are going to be the party of the working class, we've got to be the party of small businesses, because half of our jobs are in companies that have less than 500 employees. A fifth of our jobs are with companies that have less than 20 employees. And so sometimes when we start implementing rules and restrictions and mandates, we have to recognize that they are falling on the burden of small businesses. I came out of the White House, I created a small business. And I will tell you, embarrassingly went through the bio. I have multiple degrees. I don't think of myself as an idiot. And yet the entire process made me feel stupid. And so part of it is we've got to stop nickeling and diming people. We've got to recognize that in Maryland, we have one of the highest tax burdens in the country. And so one of my promises is that I am not going to be taxing my way to finding the spending to put towards these programs. Part of it is doing the heavy lifting of figuring out where there are efficiencies.
Let me interrupt for just 1 second, because what strikes me is that this notion of public-private partnership, that's a rhetorical device in so many ways, right? The private part of that partnership almost always wants something in return. It's not done out of altruism. Mm-hmm. It's done out of their best interest. They've got shareholders to respond to and to be accountable for. So when it comes to these so-called partnerships, you're going to have to give away a bit to get something from them to be involved. What does it mean to you? You know, can you give me an example of a partnership around some of the things that Flo brought up on Facebook, healthcare, education, et cetera, where the private sector says, okay, here's a bunch of money, and they're not going to do that just for kicks. They're going to do that because it's in their best interest and the best interest of their shareholders.
Yeah, and this is where I want us to change the dynamic and tenor of the conversation, in the sense that we oftentimes think that we're pitting one good thing against one bad thing, right? In the sense of bringing in private partners. But there are many situations where there are win-wins. So in the context of policies that I've already described, and to Flo's question on education, in Kalamazoo, in Pittsburgh, you're finding employers that are helping pay for free community college because their incentive, their self-interest, right? This isn't pure altruism.
They need to
train
workers. Is that
it's the pipeline for their companies. Likewise, we can figure out other parts of our economy where it is a win-win in the sense of an outdoor economy or clean energy. Right now, here in Maryland, we have the worst air pollution in the country. Here in Baltimore, we have the highest number of deaths due to air pollution. And so part of what I want to see is how can we actually both protect sustainability, but also grow our economy, because we consume more energy here in Maryland than we produce, which means that we're getting energy from neighboring states. And what that translates into is that we are exporting our dollars and we're importing pollution. And so what I want to see is how do we grow our economy when it comes to solar energy, offshore wind, in ways that it's a win-win because we are, upholding our environmental values, but we're also protecting our children. We're making sure we're reducing medical costs. And that's where I just think that for me, it's always about finding those synergies of where we're optimizing for every party involved.
And let's break there to go to Brittany in Hagerstown on the phone. Brittany, welcome to Midday with Krish Vignaraja.
Oh, thank you for having me. I did have questions about environmental policy. I believe you just touched on a few of those. I am in Western Maryland where the pipeline did just pass, and then as you know, we have the Chesapeake Bay, which is a very critical ecosystem, and I was just hoping you could explain more on some policies or stances you hope to implement as governor.
Thanks for the call, Brittany. Chesapeake Bay, particularly difficult because it's not just Maryland that's involved. Mm-hmm. It's we need consensus with Pennsylvania, with New Jersey, with Virginia, with, you know, other jurisdictions. I had Tom Pelton on, who's an environmental reporter who's written a book about this, talking about the lax regulations in Pennsylvania that causes waste from their farms to stream down into the Chesapeake and Maryland.
Yeah. And that's where we have to realize that leadership is not just at the state level, but regionally. And unfortunately, Governor Hogan, in example after example, has failed to show that. So the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiatives, REGGIE, is a perfect example of where if we showed leadership, we could have neighboring states working with us so we could actually reduce carbon emissions in a way much higher than what we are currently experiencing.
So what's that leadership look like? Meaning by example, saying, look, we're doing this and this is a good thing, so Pennsylvania, you should do it too?
No. I mean, this is where I think sometimes Democrats are far too idealistic. We've got to realize that we've got to bind people in the sense that we will agree to terms if and when other states will also join us. And I say that because, you know, finally we have sued neighboring states in terms of the air pollution that is coming from neighboring states into our area. But this is where, you know, so Brittany, you talked about the pipeline. It is fantastic that we have banned fracking in Western Maryland. It was the right thing to do. But part of what I want to see is making sure that folks in, you know, Garrett County, in Washington County, in Allegheny have an economic livelihood, because who are you kidding? No one is fracking for the fun of it. They're fracking because it's the economic livelihood that thus far has been the only opportunity. And so part of what I want to see is us investing in an outdoor economy. What that looks like is making sure that we're investing in the access to those resources, that we're marketing, that we have the best hunting, biking, birding, fishing east of the Mississippi. And that's important because after agriculture, tourism is the biggest, second biggest part of our economy. And those tourists who come for ecotourism stay longer, they spend more. And that's where I just think that there are opportunities. In terms of the pipeline, I will say that, you know, I was out there in Annapolis, protesting the Potomac pipeline. But this is where, again, to your point about what does leadership really look like, it's got to be regional, because we know that if we don't sign up to something called Orsenco, which is, you know, where we would be able to have a seat at the table working with Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, it's not enough to just ban fracking here in Maryland and to prevent the pipelines. We've got to make sure that neighboring states around us are also taking precautionary measures, because if we don't, we could be here in Maryland dealing with a situation not too different from Flint.
I have a number of comments on Facebook Live. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, but Ms. Vignaraja, you can, of course, respond to them directly after the show. But Jeff writes in, how to grow the economy. Forget tax giveaways. The nation's first statewide public utility internet service would be a huge draw. Just look at the stats on the explosion of teleworking numbers in this region. So, I mean, is that a driver of economic development?
Absolutely. I mean, and this is where I thank the comment, because in study after study, you can go to the World Bank or OECD have done study after study showing that when you increase access to the internet, you're empowering your entire workforce, particularly in areas of the state where we may not have cities, you know, and hubs, but you can bring the economy to people by bringing the internet to them. But it's also, I mean, to the point of telecommuting, you know, I was in Frederick last weekend for a debate. Anyone should go online if they want to see the debate. It was a very exciting one. We won it pretty handily, which I was pleased to see. But part of my point was that when you're in Frederick, you see a city, a county, where 40% of the people commute outside of the county. And so one of the things I want to do as governor is incentivize employers to actually allow for their employees to telecommute, because it means that you have a more productive economic workforce. You have people who are spending less time, but you also have less emissions. We know that transportation is actually the highest emitter of carbon. And so if we can get more of those cars off the road, we know that it's a win-win-win in many respects.
All right, we got to call it a day there, but I appreciate it very much. Krish Vignaraja, she's one of 9 Democratic candidates running for governor. She's a lawyer and a former policy director in the Obama administration. It's great to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, and happy Easter and Passover to everyone out there.
We've got a link to the Krish Vignaraja campaign website at WIPR.org/midday. Early voting in the June primary begins in 76 days. That's it for us today. Coming up on Monday, another in our series of conversations with the candidates, former state delegate John Olshan. Olszewski Jr. will be my guest. He's a Democrat running for Baltimore County Executive. Plus, Kamau High, the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper, will be here for the Afro Check-In. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for lunch today. They're a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Available at the Waverly and the JFX Farmers Markets here in Baltimore and online at bottomsupbagels.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce our program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Thanks again for listening. If you are celebrating Passover tonight, happy Passover. If today is Good Friday and your tradition, happy Easter. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.